So if I say guns in the West, what do you see? And with music like this in the background, I bet you see a sheriff and an outlaw facing off on a dusty main street. Or maybe a cowboy riding off into the sunset with his horse and his trusty rifle. Guns are part of the American myth. They're part of our national DNA, right? Well, not quite, says Pamela Haag. Her new book, The Gunning of America, argues that gun culture was created, advertised, and sold to Americans by the gun manufacturers, companies with iconic names like Colt and Remington. She told Charles Monroe Kane to look no further than the manufacturer of the Winchester repeater rifle, Oliver Winchester.
He made his fortune first as a men's shirt manufacturer and made his first investment in the gun industry in 1855. Now, to our knowledge, he had not owned a gun or displayed a gun in his house before that time, so he didn't have particularly passionate feelings about guns. He once described the gun unromantically but accurately as a machine made to throw balls.
A machine made to throw balls. That's a great way to put it. Yeah. It's true, I guess.
Yeah, it's accurate. He was very empirical. He was very empirically minded. So he is misremembered today as the inventor of the Winchester repeater rifle that bears his name, but he wasn't. His inventive contribution to America was an 1848 patent for an improved men's shirt collar that, in his words, remedied the evil of the too tight neckband.
Wow. Wow. We don't have a Second Amendment on that one, do we? It's funny when you think about what you're saying, because the gun is just an object. I mean, it is just a thing. Yeah, sure, it has the capacity to kill people, but it is just an object. And it seems like, from reading your book, that there's all this time in history from frontier life where it was functional. And then it had this thing that's had feelings. And it seems those feelings were manufactured by the gun manufacturers.
For much of American history, the gun was a tool. It had practical utility, it had value as a tool, just as a plow or barbed wire had value. And interestingly, it's sort of the narrative of the gun industry that brings that more functional relationship to guns to the forefront. I would say that was a dominant attitude toward guns for much of the 1800s for many Americans. But that does change. And to me, a key moment when the gun becomes more than simply a tool, more than simply an object, is really the turn of the century. Really, it's more at the time when America is post-frontier, when we're a modern society, an urban society in the 1900s. But at this time, in part because of the gun industry, the mystique of the gun really does begin to deepen.
Why? Is that just nostalgia?
Well, if you adopt the point of view of the gun maker and the gun manufacturer, it makes a lot of sense. At the moment when fewer and fewer Americans actually needed guns, how was the gun going to maintain its value as a product? How was it going to maintain its lure as something to buy? It's at this time, really, that partly as a function of the gun's obsolescence, the gun industry begins to imbue the gun with more intangible values, more symbolic values.
What was that like? So, were there ads?
Absolutely.
What were they like? They must have been pretty incredible back then.
For example, Winchester and Remington started dispatching people who they called missionaries to start stoking up zeal and enthusiasm for the gun. In the 1890s and 1880s, they started printing these chromolithographic calendars that began to sell the gun in terms of emotions. The calendars would depict these predicament scenes between man and foe or beast that remained unresolved. So adrenaline was really what was selling the guns. And the biggest change, or at least the most obvious change, really is in the advertisement.
Yeah, right.
In the 1800s, you could see ads for guns that were literally instructions, like turn knob A,
right,
move lever C. By the early 20th century, you're reading very different kinds of ads, very much about every real boy wants a gun. Mm-hmm. It's a natural instinct to want a gun. They were kind of drawing on the vocabulary of psychology, this new field of psychology. You know your son wants a gun, but you don't know how much. It's beyond words. So there's this much more emotionally charged way of thinking about the gun. And the industry itself also started drawing on history and using history selectively to develop that sense of nostalgia. And, oh, well, the gun has really been, you know, responsible for every major change in American history, and, you know, use that as a selling point as well.
You know, I'm curious, and I'm not trying to put moral considerations on historic figures, but I'm thinking of people like Colt, and I'm thinking of like Winchester and Smith and Wesson, these names we know, right? They're doing this on purpose. Yes. They're building a product that doesn't have a lot of obsolescence built into it. Their sales are down, so they're trying to drum up sales. They create some myth. They put it out there. Guns kill people, right? And certainly during wars, they kill people for sure. Do they ever write about, even though they're selling it, some in diaries or something where they're like, wow, I feel bad about this?
Well, that's a great question. They had somewhat different views, but somewhat the same view. This was a generation of self-made men who were very empirical. They tended to their contracts and to the short-term view of their business. Samuel Colt was by far the most ruthless and ambitious and laissez-faire in his view of guns. He sold to the South up until the last possible minute during the Civil War, saying that they should make hay while the sun shines. Oliver's constant refrain was really about the success of his business. He was in love with the idea of manufacturing something, whether it be a shirt or a gun, and then finding ways to make that business successful and to keep it a family business intergenerationally. So a lot of the moral energy in these men was more around being a successful entrepreneur and captain of industry. But in terms of feeling distant remorse or compunction or disquiet about what they're doing had done in the world, I didn't see evidence of that.
One of the things that really I did not know at all, and I was reading in your book, these guys, all there was wars and civil wars and revolutions happening all over the world, from Burma to South America. They were selling guns, huge amounts of guns all over the world.
Yes. All four of the major gun kings, the names we associate today with our gun culture, Colt, Winchester, Remington, Smith & Wesson, all of them survived in these years when American demand was abysmal by selling internationally. So Remington had a huge contract, for example, for 145,000 guns to France in 1870. Samuel Colt trailblazed the path and sold to the Tsar of Russia. So when we think about the consumer of the American-made gun, chances are we don't think of Tsar Nicholas II.
No, I don't.
You know, or the King of Siam, or the Juarez Revolutionary Forces. But these were the customers, and these were the contracts that sustained the American gun industry in years when otherwise it might have foundered. So really, this phenomenon, you know, we think America has this unique pathology with guns, but looked at from a business perspective, this was very much an international phenomenon of arming the world, even before we think about the frontier. Oliver Winchester stayed alive with a huge contract in 1870 for 20,000 of his rifles to the Sultan of the Ottoman Empire.
You know, it's funny. I was reading your book and I was thinking about the Western, you know, the gunslinger in the West. Did that just happen culturally on accident because of Hollywood, or was the gun industry part of that, and did that happen on purpose?
So it's important to recognize when thinking about those gunslinger stories that in reality the West was less heavily armed with these glamorized weapons and handguns. It was less gun violent than we tend to imagine retrospectively based on a steady diet of Western films and dime novels and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And there were somewhat more gun regulations just at a local level, you know, even on the frontier and in the West than we tend to think. So the myths are incredibly powerful, but a lot of those gunslinger myths really exploded in the mid-20th century. I mean, a lot of the vision we have of this really gun-violent frontier and the gunslinger, a lot of that comes about from this staggering production, cultural production of stories about the gun in the West that happens in the 1950s.
Right. So look, we keep going, right? And as we keep going in history, population increases. There's less need for guns from that population, and they need to keep up production. And so there's a tension there. What ways? How do they continue? How's the gun industry continued into even the 21st century, and through the 20th century? How do they continue selling guns?
Today, when we talk about guns, we're not really talking about guns. We're talking about so many other things. You know, a political identification. And I think today that political identification is part of what sells the guns. Ironically, every time there's new gun control legislation at the state level, sales tend to bump up.
Right.
And otherwise, actually, it's been a struggle for the gun industry. In the 1950s, you know, perhaps half of households owned guns. Today, that's more like 34%. But what the gun industry is experiencing today is that fewer customers are buying more guns.
Mm-hmm.
So in some ways, the politics around guns, ironically, help to sell guns.
We're talking about the symbol of the physical gun itself is so powerful. I don't know how you can extract the myth, true or untrue, from it. You've done all this research. You've written a 600-page book on it. You come to today. Is there any way to extract this mythology and get it back to being this functional item, or is it part of the feeling of what it is? Is it more of an emotional thing, a totem, than it is now just a functional thing?
It's definitely going to maintain a certain kind of compelling value that might be very intangible but real for some Americans. For other Americans, it doesn't have that value at all. But those meanings can also be accompanied with some understanding of the gun's commercial life, of the fact that it was also something produced by an industry and sold and self-consciously promoted, you know, as an object that could sort of be seen as a sign of masculinity or of a hardy, rugged, individualist life. So I think that what we can do is maybe try to round out our picture about the gun's life in this country so that we're not just endlessly believing that guns have always stood for this. That's simply not the case.
Pamela Hogg's book is called The Gunning of America, Business and the Making of American Gun Culture. Charles Monroe Kane talked with her